Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Toxics Trade-Offs session here at SEJ. I'd like to let everyone know that this is being recorded, and this will be posted on the SEJ list on the SEJ website sometime after the conference is ending. We're going to talk about things like BPA and other substances that are in products that we use every day, and the work that is going on to replace the more toxic of these substances, and making sure that we don't get chemicals that are even more problematic. There's a story that comes from industry. It's actually in the auto repair industry. There was brake cleaner, and this is something auto mechanics used. And in the 1990s, pollution control regulations pushed manufacturers to get rid of volatile organic compounds in there. And instead, a lot of the brake cleaner manufacturers substituted something called N-hexane. It means normal hexane. It just means all the carbons in that compound are in a straight row. And it performs well. The problem is, though, it was neurotoxic. And some of these auto mechanics ended up with some serious problems. So our panel today is going to look at California's 2008, green chemistry law, which is designed to help designed to move some of these toxic chemicals out of consumer products, and some of the issues that have come up. It's not as easy as it seems. There's reasons why these chemicals are in these products. And I'm sorry, I want to introduce, starting from the left, we have Jack Lenard, and he is from Unilever, and Veena Singla from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Carl Palmer with the California Department of Toxic Substances Control. I'm going to ask each of our speakers to talk for about 5 minutes each. To talk about their work on this. I'll ask a few questions then, and then we'll open it to first SEJ members and then other panel participants for questions. We will end promptly at 12:15. I've been told by the conference organizers not to let you out any later than that. So, okay, thanks very much. I'm going to turn it over to, I'm going to start just start from here. Carl, would you start us out?
Thanks, Cheryl. Good morning, everyone. Can I see a show of hands? How many people are from California? Well, most people. Okay. Those who aren't, welcome. Welcome, everyone. I'm going to just take my time to do a really quick overview of what our California Green Chemistry Law is, what we're doing to try to implement it, and the fundamental principles that we're trying to promote to address these challenges. And primarily, our mission, as given by the legislature and in our regulations, is to protect people and the environment from hazardous chemicals found in consumer products. And so the legislature passed the law in 2008. In 2013, after much work and struggle, we adopted regulations to implement that law. There's a handout in the back, and I'll provide this for those who want to look at it later on the web, which outlines the four key components of our regulation. And the basic structure, if you look, is that what we did first was identify chemicals that we're concerned about because of their hazard traits or because they're widely found in the environment. So identifying what we call candidate chemicals. We looked to authoritative bodies throughout the world. We pulled in their lists and their good work. And so we have several thousand chemicals on our list that we're concerned about potentially because of their inherent hazard traits. Once we did that, then the next steps are for us as the Department of Toxic Substances Control to identify specific consumer products that contain one or more of those chemicals that we have evidence that those chemicals, one, can cause harm, and two, that they're exposure to people in the environment in a way that can potentially cause significant harm, either to people or the environment. So we identify these products, and then we put them through a regulatory process. That regulatory process is centered on a requirement that someone who makes one of those products that we identify, that they go through what we call an alternatives analysis process. And what that is, it's called alternative assessment in many other jurisdictions and venues, but it's a life cycle-based look across the whole span of that product and chemicals development, from extraction to manufacture to use to ultimately end of life, and the potential impacts that those chemicals have on people and the environment. And what we asked the manufacturer to do is then to go through a whole series of analyses to look at the potential impacts with an eye towards finding a safer alternative for their product. That might be from removing that chemical. It might be using a different chemical. It might be using some other engineering or process control. But that process is the core of our regulatory framework. It is a new approach to environmental and health regulation, because the big difference is that we are not dictating a standard. We're not saying you can use this chemical to a certain concentration. We're not banning a chemical in this process. We're saying you, the manufacturer, look at alternatives and do two things. Find something safer and ensure that you don't make it worse. Don't use another chemical that maybe because you don't know its hazard properties or its exposure potential. Don't shift to that only for us to find later on that we've created a regrettable substitute and maybe harm that's just as bad or worse. So once the manufacturer does that process, they give that report to us. We determine how good it is. And if it's good, we say, great, go do it. If it's lacking, we have the ability to impose regulatory responses, as we call them, on that manufacturer that says, well, maybe you need to give us more information about your work, or you need to provide more data about your analysis, or maybe you need to inform consumers or the people that use that product more about potential risks. And ultimately, we can, if necessary, restrict the sale of that product or ban that product. So that's the broad brush regulatory structure framework that we use. And what we're doing to implement that, it's been a long haul to get our regulations adopted. We identified first three products that we're focusing on. They're very different products. One product is what we're calling children's foam padded sleep products. So we're looking at things like nap mats and baby cribs that contain foam with two flame retardants that we know are a problem. We know that kids are exposed to those things, and we're encouraging them to take a look to get rid of those compounds. The other two products we're looking at, one is what we're calling spray polyurethane foam systems. These are commercial systems that people who insulate buildings and homes and do roofing use spray polyurethane foam. It contains isocyanate, MDI, which is a threat to primarily workers. So we're asking them to look at that product. And we know in that case that there aren't really good off-the-shelf alternatives to that right now, so there's a big research question. And the third product we're looking at are methylene chloride paint strippers. Many of you may have some of those in your garage. Those cause problems because they can kill people if they're used inappropriately. There are alternatives. Some work well, some not so well, depending on the application. And so we'll be asking that industry to take a look at are there alternatives that they could move to as well. The process in general is looking at a wide array of thousands of products. So we have a work plan where we identify categories of products, and then we are going to engage with stakeholders about what we should focus on next. We're going to be this fall having webinars and meetings to talk to different stakeholders about what we think might be next. So stay tuned for that. We're also developing a guide, technical guide, for how to do alternatives analysis in our framework. There are some other ones out there worldwide. Ours is broader and deeper than most. So there are a lot of scientific and technical challenges in how you do some of these assessments and analyses, and we're providing guidance on that. Meanwhile, we have a petition process so that anyone can petition us to add a chemical and product combination in our program, and we've been recently petitioned to look at BPA in food and beverage containers, so we're looking at that. So that's a quick, I think I'm maybe within my 5 minutes.
That was rapid good. Yeah. So I'm just curious if you could tell me which of the two flame retardants that you're looking at.
Yeah, in the children's sleep products, that's TDCPP and TCEP. TDCPP and TCEP. Vina can speak more on this when she talks in some of the details of flame retardants challenges and how they're used in products.
Okay, I'd like to go next to Jack Lenard from Unilever. This is a company that is working on this issue. So take it away, Jack.
Okay, how many of you have heard of Unilever? Okay, good.
For the
not yet. in case you hadn't heard, on Monday or last Friday, we agreed to purchase Seventh Generation, company I've known for a very long time because I've known some of the people that work there, and great company. I've known them for a long time. It'll go well, assuming the purchase is finalized. The lawyers like that, but they live next door to Ben & Jerry's, which we've owned for many years. So Ben & Jerry's is an interesting company in its own right and one we're very proud of. I've been asked to talk about alternative assessments. Carl mentioned it. It's something as an industry formulator, and I've been a formulator for over 20 years, we do continuously and constantly, as they are a key part of all of our innovation and continuous improvement programs. We do our work to prevent the possibility of launching a product which has unintended consequences or unexpected trade-offs. As my friend Bill Greggs, who spoke to Cal EPA about 5 years ago, said, what are the causes of unexpected consequences? Is it a product research and development process that went wrong? Do we miss something? Is it just a different standard of criteria for success, or is it just ill-considered mandates from policy or political people? Some of these you can think of. Many years ago, we used arsenic as a pesticide. That was replaced by something better called DDT. Unfortunately, that had problems leading to organophosphates. So these things do morph over time. Flammable materials meant we wanted flame retardants, hence some of the flame retardant chemicals. Tetraethyl lead gave rise to MTBE, which had its own problems, and now we're into ethanol. So these things do happen, but trade-offs is probably a better way to look at it in some respects, because we know incandescent light bulbs used up a lot of energy, mostly in addition to lighting, they create a lot of heat. CFLs were an improvement, but yet they still had a touch of mercury in them. So I think when you talk to EPA, they said the trade-off was worth it. And of course, now we're going into LEDs, which are, from all my assessment said, are even better than those. So I think we do morph, but we also have to make sure we're always conscious of the trade-offs that we make, and hopefully those trade-offs are conscious and not unconscious. An alternative assessment, when properly done, consists of a huge set of complex, interrelated, and coordinated activities. But our principles are constant. We do make consumer products, both food, personal care, and home care. We're a global company. We have operations in well over 90 countries around the world. We are Anglo-Dutch, so Europe is our home. So a lot of things that happen in Europe, we know exactly what they're doing and vice versa. But in the end, consumers expect a product that delivers that promised performance and is safe to use for humans and the environment, is affordable, and consistently of high and predictable quality. And that product should be made, sourced, and disposed of in a safe and responsible manner. In doing so, Carl mentioned life cycle assessment. We do consider the entire life cycle of the product and the raw materials that go into it, including sourcing, manufacturing, consumer use, disposal, and breakdown products. So even when we look at each chemical, we have to know how that chemical is made. We can't pass on a contaminant or another material that's toxic just because it's farther upstream and not here. We have to make sure we consider all of those chemicals that are byproducts of the manufacturing process. The one thing I do focus on is what I call the five areas of safety of consumer products. And again, I focus on the product itself because that's what we sell. We sell the product. Our goal is to make that product better, safer, and better for consumers. First one, obviously, is human health. We look at the hazard of each ingredient and the hazard characteristics of each of the ingredients. But in determining the safety of the product, we have to look at the product use itself, the type of product, and the frequency of use. That route of exposure is a key part of our assessment. From then, we can address the overall human safety of that product. The second is environmental safety. We have to address the ability of the environment to handle the product, whether when it's disposed of and also when it's made. Terrestrial, aquatic, and atmospheric evaluations are evaluated, along with considerations for sewage treatment or other direct discharge, as that is still relevant in many parts of the world. Occupational safety obviously concerns how can we make this product safely, making sure that the workers are adequately protected. But it also includes people living around the factory, are they adequately protected? So an all-encompassing type of term for looking at that type of safety. Physical safety, something we tend to overlook, but unfortunately I'm old enough to remember shampoo in glass bottles. Glass in a bathroom setting is incredibly dangerous. It does break. So the use of plastic bottles represented a huge safety improvement because when you drop it on your ceramic tub or sink, it won't break. So I think if you look at that point of view, the plastic is actually a benefit over the glass from a physical safety viewpoint. And then lastly, microbiological safety, which is one of my biggest issues because the products that my company makes that I'm responsible for are personal care products. They're meant generally to go on your skin, very mild pH. They're not acidic nor alkaline. But that unfortunately means it's an opportunity for microbes to grow. And if we don't preserve it adequately enough, we will get microbes growing within days. Comes from the air. You open it up, microbes are in the air, they come in and they find this as, if you remember from chemistry days or biology, these are like auger plates in many respects. They grow. And so we've got to really take steps to make sure that that is minimized as much as possible. One of the things that I've said in the past is that as a practicing chemist, I can make an incredibly toxic product from the safest chemicals known to mankind if I don't preserve it well enough. Simply because our products are meant to last up to 3 years or more. And if you're a consumer, you'll stick your fingers in it sometimes. You'll expose it to the air. If you don't have basically sterile hands, you're going to expose that product to the growth of microbes. So therefore, our products have to be preserved adequately to prevent them from becoming acutely dangerous. Preservation has to ensure the safety throughout the life expectancy of the product, which in our case is generally 3 years. Products have to be made in a hygienic manner. We will not allow the use of preservatives, for example, to overcome poor manufacturing. We make sure those factories are clean. And we do follow good manufacturing principles throughout the production process. Even after all these steps are accounted for, that just tells us we have the green light to start looking at a product itself and not just the chemicals. We evaluate product stability, manufacturability, patents, regulatory acceptability, consumer acceptance, et cetera. In the end, our goal is to always provide consumers a product that safely delivers the promised value. By doing all of these activities in a holistic, comprehensive manner, we can minimize or avoid any unintentional consequences of our alternative assessment program, and are also able to continuously develop better products which are appreciated and valued by our customers and consumers. I would encourage all of you to go look on our Unilever website. You'll see what we call our Unilever Sustainable Living Plan, which sets out our goals for sustainability. Just go on Unilever.com. It's front and center. Our goals, as espoused by our chairman, Paul Polman, are ambitious, and we have said repeatedly to the environmental groups that monitor us and are part of our advisory council, in many cases, we don't know how we're going to achieve these. There's that stretching. So we're inviting people to comment, provide us with help in allowing us to meet our goals. And again, these goals are on a global basis, and they look at economic, social, as well as environmental factors that go into our products. Thank you very much.
And Jack, real quickly, can you throw out a few of the Unilever brands?
Okay. Well, Ben & Jerry's, I'm on personal care, so Dove Bar is mine. Tresemme, Nexus, Degree, Deodorant, Axe.
No. We won't go there.
You can go there.
It sells well.
You can go there.
That's not about safety, though.
We've all had to deal with it. Pond's, Caress, Lux around the world, and then we have a whole raft of global brands. On the food side, we also own Lipton. Lipton Tea is ours. Ben & Jerry's we mentioned, but Breyers, if you're in California, that's not Dreyers, that's Nestle. Ben & Jerry's competes with Häagen-Dazs, which is also Nestle, but we also own Good Humor, Klondike Bars, Hellman's. Out here, it's called Best Foods. So, we have quite a food portfolio as well.
Thank you. Okay, Vina, I know that you've been very active in all this, and so take it away.
Great. Thanks so much, Cheryl, for the nice introduction. Again, I'm Vina Singla. I'm a staff scientist with the Natural Resources Defense Council. And NRDC is an international nonprofit that employs scientists, lawyers, and policy experts to advocate for science-based policies to protect human health and the environment. And there's a handout on the back table that I'll refer to a bit during my talk if you want to pick one up. Lots of pretty colors and pictures. So I'm really delighted to be here today to talk to you all about this important topic. I especially appreciate those of you who might not be that familiar, because the environment is such a critical influence on our health. And I'll start out with a little bit more context, so apologies to those of you that already know this, but the environment, this includes what's in the air we breathe, the water we drink, what's in our homes, and the products we use every day, is a big influence on our health, but a lot of times these factors are just ignored. But think about this. The cost of environmental disease in U.S. kids is estimated to be $76 billion a year. I'll say that again, $76 billion a year. And this includes effects from chemicals like lead and mercury, as well as diseases like asthma, cancer, autism, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorders that have significant environmental contributions from sources like air pollution and from chemicals like pesticides and flame retardants. So, now, when I say the environment and chemicals, a lot of times people think like the outdoors, right, and factories spewing pollution. But in developed countries like the U.S., we spend about 90% of our time indoors. So the quality of the indoor environment is also really important in terms of our health. And I did a study. The paper just came out last week. There's some copies at the back if you're interested. Looking at what's in U.S. indoor environments. And what we found is that this graph that's at the bottom of the handout, and it's really, we see a lot of toxic chemicals from consumer products widely contaminating U.S. homes. And the chemicals that we found at the highest concentrations in U.S. indoor dust are called phthalates. And phthalates are used in vinyl products like flooring as plasticizers, also in personal care products as carriers for fragrance or to help products stick to and penetrate the skin. And what we know about phthalates is that they're hormone-disrupting chemicals, and they're linked to problems in kids like reduced IQ, respiratory problems, and birth defects. So the good news is that we've been able to understand more about the toxicity of phthalates and really track the path of phthalates and their effects from products to people. And you can see kind of how we do that at the top right here, starting with the sources of phthalates, like what's in products, how the chemicals get into people, for example, through the skin. Looking at what's actually in people, so you can measure the levels of chemicals in blood or urine. It's called biomonitoring. And then tracking health outcomes. And looking at a chemical's toxicity in animal studies can also help to understand this. So with the information that we know about phthalates' toxicity and their links to adverse health outcomes, the good news is that a few phthalates have been banned in kids' products. But the bad news is, as we've heard from everyone else on the panel, the regrettable substitute. So there's lots of phthalate replacement phthalates. You can see all those blue bars on the graph. And what we see with this regrettable substitute is one toxic phthalate being replaced by another toxic phthalate. And we can actually see this process happening inside Americans' bodies. So if you look on the back of the handout at the graph at the top, what you see is that in the light gray, one phthalate comes under regulatory scrutiny. We see the levels go down in Americans' bodies. Great, but not so good. We see the regrettable substitute in the black line at the same time, levels going up in Americans' bodies. So with this regrettable substitute, we are not moving towards safer, healthier products. And As we heard from Carl a bit, the California Safer Consumer Products Program is really the first in the nation to try to take on this regrettable substitute problem head on with this requirement for an alternatives analysis. And the alternatives analysis, I like to think about it as kind of like an interview process for a toxic chemical replacement, right, where you ask a bunch of questions about the health and environmental safety and then try to choose a replacement that's actually safer. And when this is done right, it makes a big difference. So looking at the very bottom of that red and blue bar graph, we can see this recent study where teen girls used cosmetic products without toxic phthalates and other chemicals for just 3 days. And at the end of those 3 days, big drops in the chemical levels in their bodies. So from a public health perspective, I'm very interested in breaking this cycle of regrettable substitutes with having these strong and health protective alternatives analysis. And if you remember that $76 billion figure, right, those costs and the preventable cases of cancer and asthma in kids, because we know that toxic exposures are contributing to disease, I actually see a big opportunity and a huge untapped potential for improvement in health, because if we can reduce toxic chemical exposures, then we could lift a substantial burden of disease and all be healthier. Thank you.
Veena, I want to ask you, are phthalates related to asthma directly? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So there's been studies in people, they're called epidemiological studies, where you look at chemical exposures and then track health outcomes over time. And what these studies are finding is that with prenatal exposures, so when the baby is still developing inside mom, we see associations with respiratory outcomes in the kids.
Thank you. Okay, Carl, what is your agency's biggest challenge in implementing this new policy?
Well, that's a good question. We have a lot of challenges. I think being here this morning, I'm reflecting on the panel session this morning and what Veena just highlighted. And I think one of the challenges we have is sort of the scope and scale of the questions and the potential impacts. And so when we're talking about looking at literally thousands of different chemicals in thousands of different products, one of the questions is, where do we focus first to make a difference? And then the next question for all of these things are, how can we use science and data and information to further our understanding of how we can put what we should put through our regulatory process? And then working with folks like Veena and folks like Jack, our process is really designed to have this dialogue about that, starting with the manufacturer and doing what Jack says his company, which is they're a leader in this because they're one of the model companies that has a robust and strong process of doing assessment and looking at impacts across their product line. But you contrast that with what Veena highlighted, with that if you're just looking in the indoor environment, in that climate, if you will, the number of chemicals that are there, we know that they cause problems. If you then look at the environment, I mean, there are similar data, people who've looked at the waste shed, if you will, looking at the waters that come into POTWs and say, let's do some non-target analysis of what chemicals are coming into our environment that come through from our homes and from our fields and our communities. There's similar challenges. So it's really, how do we move this thing forward? Because back to the panel this morning, my thought was it was very climate-centric. And in some sense, I think we're sort of where climate change was 10 years ago, in that we know there are problems. We don't have all the data we need. We don't have all the science that says how to make good decisions. And so we're embarking on this process. Our piece of that is narrower than the broad chemical question. And we're focusing on consumer products. But we, again, are looking at thousands of products and thousands of chemicals. So that's one of the challenges. How do we smartly move forward And put in the dialogue, both from the market standpoint, as we heard this morning, this question of market versus mandate. Our system is a little hybrid of both, because the alternatives analysis process is done by the manufacturer. They are the best know what their product specifications are. They know what their market drivers are. They know, have done the research on their product. And then it's a transparent process because they put that out for the public, with the exception of trade secrets. And then we can have this dialogue so that the scientists and the advocacy groups can look at that and provide additional perspective and information. And then we look at it and we work closely with for example, US EPA, and looking at how we're looking at all these new exposure modeling tools and the data that's out there to move this process forward. So it's new. And so the scale of this new process is somewhat daunting. And we have a small group of people here in California trying to move it forward. So that's our biggest challenge. I think we have other challenges, too, that come right along with that, which is because it's a new and different regulatory scheme and framework, talking to people about what it is and what it isn't is a challenge. So it's not a process just to ban things. It's a process to make things better. It isn't a command and control process. It uses the market, but it also has regulatory checks and balances in it. And so having that conversation, both on the industry side, where people are very distrustful of government because they think we're going to impose something, and on the advocacy side, where they think we might not do enough, is this communicating how this is going to work and then getting through it. So it's again, a nascent program, and while we wish it was going faster, and many other people do too, we want to make sure that we're using good science, that we're making good decisions, and we're using our resources wisely. So it's a big, big task.
Great. This isn't just happening in California. Jack, I know you're involved, that Unilever is involved also in work in the EU. The EU is working on this under REACH or is it under a different program? I'm sorry, I don't want to geek out on everybody. This is the European Union's chemical control law. Mm-hmm. Also is in the rest of the world. Are you working there? How are you working there as well as in California?
Being a European company, I had the, I guess, enviable or unenviable position of actually supporting our position in Europe in the U.S. And our position in Europe was we actually supported REACH, which is Registration, Evaluation, Authorization of Chemicals. It was very unpopular with my colleagues in the United States, but when we looked upon, and I worked with my team in Brussels quite extensively, they said, while we don't like everything in it, the benefits outweigh the negatives. So we went out on a limb and said we support the basic tenets of REACH as it went on. So now we're seeing that. With the Green Chemistry Initiative in California, fortunately it was a little bit easier because many companies actually came out in support of the original bill. And even though it was rather vague, I mean, you'll see some strange wording sometimes, but we supported the principles in the bill. And that's why it went through without too much of a problem. Even more recently, as Carl elaborated, the Safer Consumer Products Regulation, I think, is done incredibly well. And I've worked with Carl and his team to understand more of the principles behind it. And I think they've done it in a very good manner. And it's going to take in input from both industry and the outside community at large, and they'll come up with the right solutions, and so will industry. So I think that's where we've come. We look at the bill, we look at the benefits. If they outweigh the negatives, then generally we'll take a position in support of it and then work to see if we can find a way around those negatives.
Yeah, and now I'm going to turn to Vina. Is this working in California? Is this? Do you have hope for this program?
Somewhat of a loaded question, but but I'll say that, you know, it's the program launched pretty recently. It's just been a few years, and I think we're looking forward to what more is going to come out of the program. It is a very different and novel model, as we've heard Carl and Jack both talk about. So I think there's very certainly going to be things we have to kind of work out as we go along and new challenges. We certainly like to see things move along at a better pace as the program hopefully picks up speed. Is that it has been long wait for the first rulemaking to start on the kids' products. So we're definitely looking forward to seeing what comes out of the program next.
Great. Now is the time you've all been waiting for. It's the time you all can ask questions. I saw Valerie's hand up back there. We are going to repeat your question, okay? So we could.
We are not.
Wait a minute. Let's try to get this question in here.
Yeah. It's very lengthy.
Okay, I'm going to try to distill this. It's, do you make different product decisions in different markets for substitutes? Is that right, Valerie?
Well, like, how do you decide if something is toxic?
I mean, well, and then there's how.
And then
yeah.
There's how do you substitute one?
Okay, how do you decide whether something's toxic, and how do you substitute? Decide to substitute one chemical for another?
First of all, we have a group of safety experts, almost all based in the UK, who are experts in safety. Human safety for us, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, human safety is human safety. But these people, they've done their own studies in the past. They constantly are looking at the latest and greatest science from wherever it comes from. They read all the journals. They work actively. In this case, we do a lot of work on alternatives to animal testing, trying to come up with new methodology. We are partially funding the EPA to do some of that work. We've done a lot of work in Europe. So really, it's when we look at a chemical, we know as much as we possibly can about its entire safety profile. Including the full hazard assessment. But as I mentioned earlier, part of it is where is it going to be used? If it's in a toilet bowl cleaner, it may have a different use level than it would be if you're in a hand lotion. We do both. So it's really the application. If it's going on your skin, we have different safety considerations. If we don't have actual safety data on, say, how does it penetrate the skin? We assume it's 100%. So it's that type of assessment that all these experts, and again, they're all trained in toxicology, environmental toxicology, as well as computational and other types of safety fields. So really, it's an assessment done by our experts in the field. And if they don't think that there is a level of safety, they tell us to either get out of it, reformulate, or don't do it. So it happens. Fortunately, we don't have that many new chemicals coming into play a lot, so we pretty much know the parameters right now, but they still approve, disapprove each formulation we come up with.
Okay, question over here. Can you identify yourself? I'm sorry.
I am familiar with the way in which toxics from coal ash are reported and so on and so forth. And there's a large controversy about what yardstick should be used, number of deaths per 100,000 or things like that. And I don't know what kind of yardstick you all use, or you, the three of you, to to measure whether something is too dangerous to put in or not.
Okay, so the question is, how do you measure whether a chemical is too dangerous to put into a consumer product or not?
Right.
Okay.
I deeply admire the calm way that you all taught us. Really, I mean that sincerely. But how Davina and Jack talk with each other about acceptable risk?
Okay, so you're also wondering how advocacy groups and industry talk to each other, and less about regulators. Okay, let's let them get to the answers. Can I start with you, Carl? You wanna?
Sure. Well, let me start with the last question first, which is how they talk to each other. And one of the things that our program does is really require an open dialogue, because when we say we're going to look at a certain product, we put it out there, we invite comment, we have to go through a regulatory process to adopt it. And then once they get into alternatives analysis that Jack was talking about doing and that we require, that's put out for everyone to see, except for anything that's legitimately a trade secret. And the scientists, both in industry and in advocacy and everyone in between and the public, the consumers, can then chime in and voice concerns. And it's our job to make sure that dialogue happens in the decision-making. So that's one way. And I think other way, there's a lot of other venues where sessions like this and others where there's a lot of interest in this area that's productive.
Yeah. Sure, that's a great question, right? When we say safer or safe, what do we mean? How do we define that? And I think it is definitely an ongoing dialogue and a question that we're all wrestling with. And I think you know, from our perspective, something that's really important about the Safer Consumer Products Program is a little bit of a step away from that focus on what's the risk here and let's put a number on it, and looking at the hazards of the chemical. So are they inherently toxic, right? Because if you ask a question like, what's the acceptable risk for cancer for a 6-year-old, right? Is it 1 in 100,000 or 1 in 1,000,000? The answer is that's going to depend on who you're asking, right? Is it the family of the kid? Is it, you know, and it's a values-laden question, right? But if we step back from that and say, you know what, maybe there shouldn't be carcinogens in baby products, then that's a different perspective, and that's very much more our perspective, is to focus on reducing the hazard of chemicals, and that will automatically reduce the risk.
I'm not going to answer questions on how our toxicologists work, but you sort of, there's the toxicology practices around the world focus on margins of safety and things like that. So I'm not that. I'm a chemist, by the way. I am from Davidson College, so a neighbor of Charlotte. Well, it's in the same county, so welcome. In terms of discussions with environmental groups, I think we've gotten a lot better over the years. We now will invite a lot of those groups to come in. We're not always on the same page. We agree to disagree in many cases. But we like hearing the opinion, because sometimes there may be something we hadn't thought of or didn't know. So I think a lot of times we actually invite them in to have that discussion, because maybe it'll open our eyes up, especially on some things of more global importance. We try to make sure we get all inputs before we make up before we decide where we want to go. So I see the Environmental Working Group is up there. It's an interesting group to work with and collaborate with, but at least we have that dialogue. And it's sometimes we disagree. Sometimes we actually find areas of common agreement.
Okay. Great. Go here to Bernardo. Identify yourself.
Okay, there's a couple of issues there. Well, one, Yeah, the question is, you know, how is what public information or what information are we using, and how does the people have access to that in our decision making and through the process? And a couple of things. One is we rely almost entirely on public information. We're not generating our own information, and with the exception when somewhere down the line we might get some trade secret information, which we have to protect. But in general, we're using public information to make decisions about what we're going to focus on. And then once we put that all the information, when we pick the three things we're starting with first, we put out documents that said, this is why we're picking them. Here are the studies we looked at. Here's what our rationale is. Here's the questions we have. And then it's a very public dialogue, both in rulemaking formally and informally with industry and advocacy and everyone in between. Then when when we get to the point where people are actually doing the alternatives analysis, will be posted on our website. We will be inviting public comment on those analyses, and we will be reviewing them ourselves and going back to the people who are doing it, saying, you need to adjust this or deal with it. So it'll be a very transparent process in that regard. But it's also a question of finding all the good data. I just wanted to touch on this concept of traditional. This is very non-traditional, and traditional risk assessment-driven data and processes. That science, if you will, is very solid and has developed over the last 30-plus years. We're, as Vina highlighted and Jack alluded to, we're looking at not just risk, but hazard and an approach to decision making, and that is going to be largely dependent on the availability of data. So it's very important that both we can develop new data and share data so that it can be in the community of everyone challenging it, and then make good decisions. So that's kind of what the process facilitates.
If I could just comment briefly on that for a moment. So Carl mentioned the candidate chemical list that the Safer Consumer Products Program has, and they actually have a fantastic resource on their website where you can search this database to look through all the thousands of candidate chemicals and find a compiled right there. It's all free. All the hazard information that's been identified by authoritative and expert government bodies that this candidate chemical list relies on. So you can just look up the chemical, and right there it'll tell you this has been associated with reproductive toxicity, developmental toxicity, and you can go back to the original source. So it's a really great resource to find out basic toxicity information about these thousands of candidate chemicals on their list. And I'll just put in a little plug for my blog. If you're interested in following some of the developments on safer consumer products, I blog about it frequently. If you just Google my name and NRDC, it'll come right up.
Okay. I'm going to go to Katie and then Brent, then over to this side of the room. Go. Please identify yourself. Okay, so it's how many companies are involved in the products that the agency is looking at. How long do these companies have to respond? And what was the third part of that? How long do you expect?
I'm just imagining getting a lot of data back and future reports to read and what kind of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay, the resources that the agency has to address it.
Thank you. That's a good question. Well, the first three products we are looking at, the children's products, the spray foam, and the methylene chloride, are, relatively speaking, the people we would actually regulate, there aren't that many of them. The children's products, we're not entirely sure, but it's in the dozens probably. And for spray foam, there's about 20 manufacturers. And in methylene chloride, again, it's a relatively small. The vast majority of those products are made by less than a dozen companies. So the dialogue we're going to have and the people who actually regulate are the manufacturers, the people that make that product and sell it in California. That's not to say there aren't a lot of other people affected in the supply chains of those products, potentially. But the people who actually regulate is somewhat manageable. That said, when we start looking at other categories in our work plans, for example, personal care products, there are hundreds of companies that make certain products, and there are dozens of companies that make other types of products. And so there is a bandwidth issue there for us. And so we're balancing not only the merit of the chemical and product we're looking at and its the exposure potential of harm in the environment, but also our ability to tackle that with the limited staff and resources that we have. I will say, also in the spirit of collaboration, we have a memorandum of understanding with US EPA as well as the state of Washington and Oregon to try to share information and talk about what we're all doing in this space. There's a lot going on in terms of developing the science and tools for looking at how you might make choices about where these chemicals that Vina highlight, where what products actually contain them, where they might come from, because it's a relatively new field in terms of looking at exposure science and where to focus our energy. So it's a challenge.
Okay, Brett.
Hi, I'm Brett Chase, an investigative journalist in Chicago. I'm just curious, other states that are looking at similar legislative this issue, and also who are the leading companies and industry groups that are trying to fight any sort of legislation?
Okay, so you're asking about the other states that are looking at similar legislation, and who are the leading industry groups that or companies that are fighting this. Is that right? Okay.
Sure. Well, at this point, we're pretty unique in terms of states in terms of having this model. There are a handful of other states who are very active in green chemistry programs in states like Washington and Oregon and Vermont, who have, for example, product disclosure laws for children, products that contain hazardous chemicals, children, Massachusetts. But there's a lot of activity. US EPA also is doing a lot that you may be aware. They recently revised TSCA, and so there's potential for a great opportunity there for EPA to take more action. But we're really the only ones with this specific framework. It's actually probably closer in some sense to things going on in Europe in terms of some of the models there. In terms of who's fighting, I don't know that I would use that word right now. I think everyone is engaged. Certainly the manufacturers of products that we've already looked at are very engaged and concerned, certainly. For the children's products, the trade organizations have been fairly supportive, in part because they realize that's a fairly straightforward thing to do. Take that chemical out. There are safer alternatives. They're probably cheaper. So they're going to be more cooperative. For spray foam, that's a very large technical challenge. The ACC and they're
and ACC is the American Chemistry Council. That's the main trade group of the chemical industry. It's not the only one.
And their Center for Polyurethane Institute has been very engaged with us. I think it's safe to say they're not happy about our focus on that, but I got to give them credit that for the past 2 years since we started talking about this, they've been very helpful in providing us data and information for their perspective. So, we're a regulatory body. For the most part, businesses don't want to be regulated. You heard that this morning, mandated versus market. But the good thing is that it's very transparent and it's new, so people are very engaged. And while people may not like it, we've had general support from the days of the bill to adopting our regulations. This concept is worth moving forward on.
Yeah, I'll just say a little bit more about some of the states that are leading. Washington State was mentioned with their they have a law called the Children Safe Product Act, and it requires reporting of a number of chemicals of high concern to children. And they have an online database where you can go and look and see what chemicals have been reported by whom and what products. So it's a great resource for families to choose safer products for their kids. Maine just put out some new data from their phthalates reporting law. I mentioned phthalates, those chemicals that are found in high levels in the indoor environment and used in lots of different kinds of products. So some really interesting information coming out of Maine on what phthalates are in what products, because even though phthalates are kind of ubiquitous, they're used in a lot of products, they're also sort of mysterious because we don't know exactly what phthalate is used in what. So there's definitely interesting information coming out of Maine. And you know, Carl mentioned the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA. That's the federal law that regulates almost all industrial chemicals and that go into consumer products and building materials. And that's been overhauled for the first time in decades, and we're in the implementation process now. And what we are seeing is the chemical manufacturers and their industry trade group, the American Chemistry Council, coming forward as typical to already defend asbestos. So I would say that we're not surprised by that, and that's something like pretty typical that we've seen. And there's sort of a from our perspective, a difference between the chemical manufacturers like Dow and Exxon and the chemical users, the manufacturers that are using these chemicals to put into their products. And we really hope that Dow and Exxon will become more progressive and start to manufacture safer chemicals for their customers to use.
Yeah. Just one comment, also answering it. Your question earlier, I think one of the things that we as a consumer product industry could always do a better job at is communicating to the public how we do our job. What decisions do we make? I know as Unilever, we've started doing that. We need to do better, and I think one of the opportunities in working on the Safer Consumer Products Regulation is we now have another vehicle to do that. It's to have somebody else sort of reviewing our processes and making sure that we haven't missed something. So really it's an opportunity for us to have DTSC in California actually do some of the, we'll say, make our process a little bit more transparent. So if we can have them do some of that type of work and educate the public as well as others, then it's done us a service as well. So I think there are positives to it. And I think as we work with them, we're going to start seeing that some of the things we've been doing all along are good. Maybe there's some we can improve, but that's the type of dialogue we want to have.
Can I just add to the Jack's point is that one of the things that we found is that in talking to various manufacturers, both in formulated and manufactured products, is that depending on the product, many companies don't have the awareness that Jack's company has in what is actually in their product, because they have they're making something, they have specs for it, they have multiple suppliers, those suppliers have suppliers, and when you start looking at these complex supply chains and a number of different chemicals used across the board, it becomes very difficult sometimes to actually know what's in your product. And so I think part of the awareness thing is not just for the consumer, but also to stimulate in the industry to the forces that can push up and around through the supply chains to make sure there is transparency and knowledge. Because even if a company wants to do the right thing, if they don't know what they're getting, it's a challenge.
Great. In the back here. Okay, so the question is whether TSCA reform might hamstring some efforts in California, because I think because of the state overriding, it overrides state efforts.
Well, I won't be as strong as the speaker was this morning, the pro tem, excuse me, in terms of California versus the nation, but we have a long history in California and throughout the country of states both implementing federal laws and enforcing federal laws and doing work to move those spaces forward, both in innovation and different approaches. We strongly believe that. We were a very strong voice in that dialogue for TSCA to ensure that the preemption provisions were as amenable to the continuing that as possible. And there were some last-minute changes that I think were helpful. I think, in general, a lot of the changes were good for EPA, and I'm hopeful that their ability to implement the law will be stronger. They have a very ambitious schedule in front of them. From our standpoint, at this point, we're moving ahead full steam. I don't anticipate any major preemption challenges in their near term. We have a good relationship with EPA. The landscape is large. There's a lot of work been done. So it's more collaborative, and even there's a lot of knowledge out there about
how things should move forward. Ultimately, there may be some times when there is an issue there. We're confident that if we do good work, that we'll be able to get waivers if we need them, and that we'll continue to collaborate, and hopefully everyone gets to move forward, at least in parallel.
If I could just comment on that briefly. We definitely agree that the new TSCA is an opportunity for EPA to finally start protecting the public from toxic chemicals, but we really have to see the agency break free of chemical industry influence and strongly implement the law. And in order to restrict dangerous chemicals and ensure that new chemicals are safe for human health and the environment. And unfortunately, the universe of toxic chemicals out there is quite large. So, even with EPA's new mandates to complete timely reviews, they're still only going to be able to move through a handful of chemicals at a time. So states can and should continue to take action to protect their citizens from toxic threats.
Yeah, and another issue is, of course, funding for EPA to implement this new law, because the budgets are shrinking and the budget cutters always have their scissors out.
But Jack, there are user fees
in the new TSCA,
so industry is going to be paying for it. Yeah. I'm not sure how they work.
And there's, of course, debate about how big those fees should be.
And in the end, Barbara Boxer, I think, voted for the new TSCA, so she protected her interests.
Here in California. Okay, question.
My name is Leslie Lippert, I'm a science person in San Francisco. And what I would love to understand, maybe Jackie can speak to this, is sort of the logic. Like, I understand pesticides, farmers would argue that it grows the plant better, or that flame retardants, the product doesn't burn. But why phthalates and parabens when there are clearly other options that companies are using, like, that make the plastic bottles just as plastic-like or just as flexible?
Okay, so you're asking specifically about phthalates and parabens and also plasticizers in general? Yeah. What the logic of keeping those in products, Jack?
It's a matter of assessing what's out there, and if you're putting, say, a liquid in a plastic bottle, do you do the studies to see if there's any migration from the plastic into the liquid? Are there alternatives? Are those alternatives worse, even though they may have one characteristic that's better? So we try to look at it from that very holistic point of view, with obviously safety as probably the ultimate concern. But we do actually do leaching studies to see if anything does leach, whether it's we don't use phthalates per se, but does anything get into the actual product that you use? So these are all the considerations that we do. We want to make sure we have the science. We don't want to take it out because, even though it may not be a factor at all. In terms of preservatives, I'm not a microbiologist, but I spend a lot of time with my microbiologist community. Part of the issue with preservatives is that bugs do become resistant to them. And that's the biggest fear, is unlike a normal chemical, you just can't constantly replace them, because if a bug becomes resistant, you need something totally different. So the idea of preserving a palette of preservatives is really critical. So again, we'll look at the parabens, we'll look at all other types of preservatives, and try to see which one we can use the least of to deliver the benefit in the safest possible manner. We were faced with some other preservative issues in Minnesota a couple years ago, and I said, we're going to meet your law, but I cannot guarantee the product will be any safer, because we're going to be using more preservatives, different kinds. We're going to be changing perhaps the pH of the product, and if you're talking about making something that goes on your skin more alkaline or more acidic, you may have more issues with your skin that way. And you may lose this ability to prevent microbes from becoming resistant. So we have to look at it in a little different light. They're used in very low levels. Sometimes if you switch to another preservative, you may in fact run the risk of having to put in a lot higher levels. So all these factors are weighed. We know a lot about the science of all those preservatives. And in general, they're meant to kill bugs. So I have issues with my own, with other companies, other people, spokespeople for the industry, and they say, I want to tell everybody our ingredients are safe. And I said, no, you've got to qualify that. I don't want a drum of that in my living room. But focus on the fact that we use them safely, i.e. in our factories, they're handled appropriately, and they're safe in our products. But to say that any chemical is safe is just wrong. So you've got to manage it properly. So I know on things like parabens, that's one of the things we put on our global website in January, I believe, a little bit more explanation about what it is, why we use it. We're trying to increase our communication with the general public in that way. It's probably not gone well far enough at the present, but it's a start for us. So you're free to read that. And if we're wrong, I mean, if we get more data, we will change it. There's other issues out there now which we're dealing with, but we've lost a number of preservatives over the years, and it's really difficult to keep your product safe without using some of these.
Follow up? Okay, the question is, what do the natural products that don't use parabens or phthalates, what do they use?
Sure, so I will preface this with I am not an expert on preservatives, so I can't speak to, what some of the specific preservatives might be. But something we are seeing is... unfortunately, some more regrettable substitutes in the paraben space where there's specific parabens like methyl, ethyl, butyl paraben, and we see in some products getting rid of one of those and going to another, so going from methyl to ethyl or, some switch-outs like that, and still claiming to be paraben-free if they got rid of one and put in another. So that's that could definitely not a good replacement. And I think, the question of preservatives, it highlights sort of a larger issue and that I alluded to before, in that there needs to be a better pipeline of safer chemicals to perform some of these functions in terms of research and development coming out of some of the chemical manufacturers. So, right now there's really a problem with green chemistry education. And in our schools, there's a lot of chemistry students don't get any sort of basic green chemistry training or, thinking about potential health and environmental effects of chemicals. So there's sort of a fundamental problem in terms of the educational pipeline and educating chemists that can start to think about the problem more holistically and develop safer chemicals to go into the pipeline to perform some of these functions.
Go ahead, Jack.
I can also do a quick comment. We do look at alternatives. It doesn't necessarily have to be a preservative, but we know you can put these in your refrigerator and have a life expectancy of 3 weeks. That's generally not acceptable for a hand and body lotion. You can make an aerosol because there's a lot of ethanol in those, but there's other issues with that. I mean, the ethanol will preserve it. Ethanol's got problems, and an aerosol is a much bigger container. So, again, we look at all of these. There are sodium benzoate is one that people use a lot of.
Question is about seventh generation.
You can look on their website, and they will explain, because I went and looked at their website. They do explain. Occasionally they use something that they don't really like, but that's all the only thing that works. Natural and non-natural. I can tell you that one of the big fears of our microbiology community is the use of natural oils, because they're variable, and they come with a lot of things in it that we don't always predict. First of all, natural oil is made up of hundreds of chemicals, and they vary from season to season depending on the growing conditions. So that's a fear, because what microbes are coming in, they have to be able to protect the product against those. So this is something that they fear. But even something like formaldehyde is perfectly natural. It's present in just about every fruit and vegetable as a natural part of chemical processes. And sometimes they're not insignificant. So this whole thing, natural, unnatural, it's really, is the product safe or not? And that's what we look at. In some cases, you can use better, safer preservatives. They just don't last as long. And there are some that are incredibly touchy. Today they work fine, tomorrow they may not. So there's a lot of unknowns in this.
I just wanted to add that, as Vina alluded to, education is a big part of this for all of us. But just a shout out, you might look at UC Berkeley's Greener Solutions program. In 2006, our original Green Chemistry Report had various initiatives that we wanted to look at, which was including working with education to create a green workforce to people who are trained in new technologies and new ways of thinking and using green chemistry principles. And so go look at the Greener Solutions site, and you'll see they have pilot projects where PhD students are looking at and partnering with businesses to look at real problems and looking at using new ways of thinking, like applying biomimicry. The planet's been, for millions of years, evolving to solve problems. So looking at things like working with Levi's on fabric finishings to say, are there different ways that we can look at polymers and maybe looking at shellfish and things like that. So it's pretty exciting stuff, and I'd encourage you to go look at it.
One more plug. Preservatives specifically were part of something called the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council, GC3. It's run out of the University of Massachusetts Lowell, which also runs the Toxic Use Reduction Institute. We now have an open challenge program funded by industry, but with participation from academics and NGOs. And we all came together and recognized this is a major issue, and we're just opening it up to crowdsourcing, trying to figure out if something else out there is unique and different and something we haven't thought of. We're not sure of the success, but at least we're all on the same page, and that's been a really positive thing for the industry.
Yeah, the Green Chemistry and Commerce Council, I'll admit, is a big source of mine. They really do some stuff at this interface. Okay, Muriel, you had a question. Please identify yourself.
I'm retired from Sacramento. Just thinking about the tens of thousands of chemicals that snuck into the marketplace and weren't tested or regulated,
okay, so you're asking about the chemicals that were not tested before there was the modern chemical control laws, and what's going to happen to those? So you're asking for predictions.
That's a good question. There are a lot of different things. I mean, some of these sort of naturally get studied in the academia, but there are other efforts. For example, US EPA is investing a lot in looking at high throughput analysis of and trying to build a better library, if you will, of information of all these chemicals. It's a huge, huge task, and with a long way to go. But maybe Vina or Jack could speak more about what's going on.
I'm saying we're coming down to the last couple of minutes here, so.
Sure, I'll keep it brief. I think. We talked about some of the regulatory programs underway to look at chemicals and products, both federally and in states. And I would just add that the markets and companies that are leading also have a big role to play. As we heard about some of the efforts at Unilever, and there's other leading companies that can get ahead of this problem and really focus on the safety of their products as they're in development and coming out with safe products from the beginning.
And from our point of view, while we look at Tosca, we really pay a lot more attention right now because they're doing these assessments on hundreds and seemingly tens of thousands. But even before REACH was Canada and their Environmental Protection Act, which to me is by far the best managed chemical assessment program in the world. It's under CEPA. But it's really well done, and they've done through all the high priority chemicals and the medium priority. They're now focusing on the lower priority ones, so they're way ahead of anybody.
Canada.
Health Canada has a phenomenal program, which should have been the model for everything, and it's just an outstanding program. Industry, NGOs, academics, I think, pretty much support it, but they've done a great job.
And CEPA, to which Jack referred, is the Canadian Environmental Protection Act. I'm going to have to say it's time for us to go. I think our panelists are willing to stick around for a few minutes for those of you who have further questions. This was a great discussion. Let's thank our panelists.